Thanks, Chetan, and generally thanks for the organizers of this wonderful workshop. Learning a lot of things that I basically have no clue about. I barely know what computation is, let alone quantum computation. But I'm learning. What's going on here? So there's the title that I sort of gave by instinct, because this is a sort of talk that I thought might go well with some of the field theory oriented condensed matter theorists in this program. So this particular talk is based on work that I've been doing primarily with Matthew Fisher here and with R. Shankar at Yale. But over the years, I've collaborated on related issues with a large number of people. So let me just read out the names of some of the students. Puyon Gaemi is a student at MIT. He's my student. And Michael Levin is a student of Shougang Wen, also at MIT. And Alexei Motronich is a postdoc sitting somewhere in this room out there. Ashwin Vishwanath, junior faculty at Berkeley, and a number of other famous people. Leon is right out here. There's other people aren't here. And I myself am T Central. I'm at the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore. Have some affiliation with MIT, but much of this work, much of the background for this work actually started when I was still at MIT. So while preparing this talk, it seemed to me that for this audience, it might not make that much sense to plunge directly into this latest wrinkle, this general body of work that we've been doing for the last several years, but rather that it made more sense to start with some general remarks on topological phases and topological quantum matter, which is at least, the first topic of the two topics that have been put together in this program, topological phase and quantum computation. And so that will hopefully set the stage for why this latest wrinkle, this latest addition to this growing body of knowledge on the kinds of things we work on is perhaps of interest to this community, and why perhaps, you might care to listen and gain something from people like me, who are solid state physicists, thinking primarily about issues in solid state physics. So in general, as a solid state physicist, the kind of questions one wants to ask about topological phases of matter are first whether they exist in real solids or other artificial solids, cold atoms or whatever. Well, do they exist commonly? Do we come across them every day, or will we come across them every day at some point in the distant future? And if they do occur, how are we going to find out, and how are we going to manipulate them? But so these are all obviously...
Are you going to answer question number zero? What are they? Okay.
No. I can tell you by example, but I can't. But
I know. I read the whole book by Wen, and didn't quite understand what is meant by the topological phase.
Yeah, so there is a problem in the field in that I don't think we have a general notion of what we mean by topological phase.
The buzzword exists before the subject.
No, the subject exists in the following sense. Right? So if you restrict your definition of the word sufficiently, there is a useful definition, but Tropp has used the word very loosely, and we wanted to cover cases where, which don't quite fit this restricted definition.
But you want to say, for example, restricted definition, there's the low energy effective field theory is a topological.
Exactly. So that's the restricted definition, and one can use that, right?
I'm just guessing. How about this definition? Hamiltonian with a degenerate ground state.
Where the number of ground states depends on.
Yeah, the number of ground states depends on which manifold the system lives on.
Yeah, exactly.
Depends on boundary conditions.
Yeah, so suppose you have a system of porous, it's degenerate, but you don't see broken symmetry, then you should call it topological. I'm guessing.
No, so in general, I would agree with that, except that in solid-state physics these days, we use the word more generally than just that. Sorry?
We often mean interesting phases.
Yeah, so we use the word topological phase much more generally than that restricted definition. That's why I was hesitating to answer Shankar's question. I'll talk about that as we go along. A few days we were chatting about how, sometimes you just put in the title of your talk and immediately there are 10 questions. This is more or less than that. It's a lot of fun. In any case, so we can have lively debates on what topological phases are, but as Shankar said, it's a zeroth order question that I won't answer. But since, at least some of them exist, I guess at least in those cases we know what we're talking about. Okay, so do they exist? Obviously, yes. There's a example that everyone knows about, quantum Hall effects. Fractional quantum Hall states are interesting. At least simple examples of topological phases. Here, I guess everyone knows what the heck it means, right? What a topological phase is. But as we also know, it requires fairly special circumstances of being in two dimension and having strong magnetic fields. And most of the time, at least historically, it's traditionally been seen only in two-dimensional electron gases and so on. Now, there's a long-standing and important question in solid-state physics. Completely for parochial solid-state reasons, there's no dreams of building a quantum computer, as to whether this is the only example or whether there are other examples of topological phases. Right? And a very significant theoretical development, work of many people, over 15, maybe longer time period, 15 years, perhaps longer, is that indeed, at least theoretically, such topological phases which share many aspects of the phenomenology, or the theoretical phenomenology of the quantum Hall effect, but not its, quantized Hall conductance, but other general theoretical structure, can in principle occur in any spatial dimension, 2D, 3D, 26D, whatever, and without strong external magnetic fields. So in some sense, it lifts some of these special restrictions on the kinds of special circumstances that you need to get a quantum Hall type phenomenon in a real solid. And so this certainly is some amount of is part of the reason to imagine that perhaps in the distant future, if the basic ideas on which this program is has been constructed is to work out, then perhaps the way it might work out is that there'll be a non-quantum Hall realization of a topological phase, which can actually then be used to make quantum computer, perhaps. The sobering, footnote to this wonderful theoretical progress, which is that experimentally, the answer to whether there exist other topological phases other than the quantum Hall effect, at least the current experimental answer, is a very striking and significant no. And it's not because people haven't tried. It's certainly been a bit of a holy grail in solid-state physics for a long time, and basically to date, the answer has been a rather disappointing no. So that's perhaps good to keep in mind as one goes forward in this program. Because certainly, I think it'll be very, very significant and a small baby step towards the ultimate goals of this program to have even one concrete experimental realization, however simple, of a topological phase outside of the quantum Hall effect. This is, experimental proof of principle. And so a lot of work going on in solid-state physics to answer this question, both from the experimental side and with a lot of help from theorists, and perhaps it'll happen sometime soon, perhaps it'll happen in a very long time, we don't know. So how common do we expect these to be? So the conventional folklore among solid-state physicists is that, these would not at all be common, require really special kinds of materials, common folklore within the community of believers. and this common folklore is probably right, that at least that's, you know, but the truth is we don't really know. And the reason we don't really know, at least part of the reason, is that at present we lack good experimental probes to reveal such a topological ordered phase, a topological phase, or related phenomena, if it actually occurs in some particular material. And this might require, quite possibly, a completely different toolbox for experimentalists, you know, quite different from the standard tools that experimentalists use to detect ordinary phases of matter. So, in other words, you know, even establishing that in real solids or in other materials, you know, cold atoms or whatever, that you have such a phase when it exists, establishing it might require a revolution in terms of experimental technology as well. So there's, you know, lots of big changes that are needed within conventional solid-state physics or atomic physics to even take baby steps in this field. Bit of a sobering thought for many of us, I guess. Now, as to how common they really are, you know, it's an example that I like to give to myself and to various and to anyone who cares to listen, is that, you know, let's think about ordinary phases of matter. We've known about ferromagnetism for centuries, but as a magnetic phenomenon, it's actually quite rare in solids. Antiferromagnetism is the much more common magnetic phenomenon, but we've actually known about it for only less than 70 years. You know, by now maybe it's 80, I don't know. So certainly less than 100 years. Now the reason is that ferromagnetism is very easy to detect. You can do completely macroscopic experiments and detect ferromagnetism, but antiferromagnetism requires much more, you know, intricate probes. Because you have to measure at least the spin susceptibility as a function of temperature to know that something's going on. But really, you really nail down that a material is antiferromagnetic, you need new probes like neutron scattering, which weren't even imaginable 100 years back. Right? So this tells you that if you don't have the right probes, then you may just assume that, you know, the only common things are the things that you already know how to detect. Right? So if one keeps this in mind, then one might perhaps allow oneself, at least after a few glasses of beer, a very optimistic view that perhaps these topological phases are very common. 50 years down the road, you know, everyone would be holding a topological material in his hand, but we just haven't found out yet. You know, so I was once speculating that perhaps icebergs live in topological phases. So they'd certainly be very common, at least by one definition. But in any case, that's an extreme optimistic view, and it's a matter of opinion at this stage whether this view is right or this view is right. Said my guess is that it's probably more like that, but we don't really know. So how to detect and manipulate topological phases? And here, you know, basically very few ideas that exist, and that's part of the reason why we don't know for sure whether any given material, for instance, an interesting frustrated magnetic material in three dimensions, something, you know, is it a topological phase, or does it have topological structure in its ground state over and above any broken symmetry that might exist? So things of that sort, you know, we need much better techniques to detect these topological phases. And many, many new ideas will be needed in the context of specific experimental systems to be able to detect topological order if it exists. So some old ideas that we played around with, and when we're thinking about Q-plate superconductivity, and using the possibility of topologically ordered Morton insulators as a springboard for superconductivity. And the idea in that context was to use the possible proximity of such a topological phase to a phase that we understand much better, some conventional broken symmetry phase. A specific example may be if you took some sort of insulator which lives in a topological phase, described, for instance, in the simplest context by a Deakin fine Z2 gauge theory. So that has, you know, non-trivial topological structure. You could imagine tuning that insulator through a phase transition to a superconductor, and then using the known, using one's ability to control, you know, various aspects, various properties of a superconductor, to create and then subsequently detect the non-trivial excitations of the topologically ordered phase. For instance, in such an insulator, there is a vortex excitation, a Z2 vortex, which in the gauge language is a particle that carries the flux of the gauge field. And this object morphs into the familiar HCO2E quantum vortex of the superconductor as you tune through this transition to the superconducting phase. So this then suggests that, you know, we know how to make HCO2E vortices in superconductors. So you make the HCO2E superconducting vortex, move the system into this phase so that it evolves back into the this non-trivial excitation of this insulator. So you created this thing, and to detect it, you sort of bring it back into this phase, and then see if you nucleate this vortex or not. And then we know how to detect these vortices again. So these experiments of this kind were done in the context of two-plate superconductivity, but unfortunately didn't quite work out. But at least, you know, it's proof that these kinds of experiments can be done, and perhaps will be done, if there's good reason to believe that you have at least certain simple topologically ordered phases proximate to some simple broken symmetry states, particularly superconducting states. So this, you know, one way in which one might detect or, you know, really nail down that some insulator that one might suspect is topologically ordered is indeed topologically ordered. So other experiments that one can dream of in contexts like this, one could imagine making a sandwich between the superconducting state, this exotic insulator, and a superconducting state again, form a superconductor, exotic insulator, superconductor junction, Josephson junction. And in this situation, at least, you know, if this sort of junction is made appropriately, you can expect to get fractional AC Josephson oscillations depending on the charge, on the fractional charge that possibly exists in this exotic insulator. So that would be a way of detecting fractional charge in this exotic insulator. Right? So there are some old ideas, but, you know, in specific experimental context, we need to look at what might actually work and to propose definite experiments that people in the lab can actually do to test any suspicions one might have of the existence of topological phases. So this sort of goes back to the zeroth order question, what are topological phases? So what's the general lesson that one learns in solid-state physics or quantum many-body theory from the very existence of topological phases like the quantum Hall effect? So there's one point of view that I like very much, which is to say that one thing that you learn is that you can have what one may call emergent non-locality in extended quantum systems. Namely, you have interesting ground states of extended quantum systems that have excitations which have long-ranged interactions that are absent in the microscopic Hamiltonian. As in many other contexts, these long-range interactions, one might imagine capturing them in a mathematical description that relies on gauge theory, the standard motivation given for gauge theory. This may perhaps be, you know, in the long run, might turn out to be not the most efficient mathematical description, perhaps the clumsy description of this emergent non-locality, but it's not an incorrect description, and it's at least the most familiar to most physicists at this stage. So in the quantum Hall example, for instance, we have excitations that carry fractional statistics, and that really means that this infinitely long-range statistical interaction between two excitations, which are not there in the microscopic electron Hamiltonian. Right? And the same is true for simple topological faces, you know, Z2 ordered insulators, Z3 insulators, and the double churn Simons series that many people here have studied. In all these cases, you have excitations that have infinitely long range statistical interactions, and in above ground states, which are ground states of Hamiltonians with purely local interactions. Right? So, and the gauge theory description is some way to mathematically capture this infinitely long range statistical interactions. So in a sense, you know, this is a partial characterization of a topological face. It's what we often call emergent gauge structure, but it's sort of just preferred to, this is the basic physics, and the gauge structure is a way to mathematically describe this physics.
May I ask, so you refer to cases where you really have a topological kind of gauge theory.
Right.
So the question is also, if you talk about emergent gauge invariance, whether there are dynamical terms generated to get long range propagating modes.
Right, yeah.
This could also be there.
Right, listen, absolutely.
You are really talking about churn Simons, induced churn Simons.
Yeah, it could be, you know, like Z2 or Z3 or something, I mean, discrete theories which double churn Simons, things of that sort. So, you know, this sort of falls under the definition of, I mean, it's one answer to Shankar's question, you know, what are topological faces? You can restrict your definition to just include these kinds. So I'll talk in a minute about other kinds of situations. So in these cases, the information about the statistics and so on is encoded in global properties of the ground state wave function. And, you know, at some broad philosophical level, it is this fact that this information, the global properties of the ground state wave function that underlies this entire suggestion that perhaps this can be exploited to do quantum computing.
So in all these models, there are usually also all kinds of other degrees of freedom which can still be there, no?
Sure.
And then
that's
you still
right.
Call them topological cases because they can have this degeneracy.
And there will be some excitations at least that have these infinitely long-range statistical interactions. There may be others that don't have them, but you know, it's okay. But you know, in solid-state physics, some of the most interesting developments, at least things that I've been working on, and many other people in this room, been working on the last 2 or 3 years, perhaps more than that. Is to go beyond what one may call, within this restricted definition, a topological phase. And what we've learned is that these quantum Hall type topological phases are just the tip of the iceberg, and really are a much more wonderful variety of interesting phases, which sometimes we loosely call topological phase, but perhaps shouldn't exist. And one common feature is that many of these non-trivial quantum ground states have similar emergent non-local interactions between the excitations. Perhaps not these infinitely long-range statistical interactions, but some other kind of non-local interaction that emerges even though the microscopic quantum Hamiltonian has purely local interactions. So in the spirit of this entire program of topological quantum computing, you know, it seems to make sense to ask the question, what other possible new quantum technology could these be used for? We know how to, we know meaning, the proposal, the tenet of topological quantum computing is to use these topologically ordered ground states of the quantum Hall type to do, for some interesting application, right, which is quantum computing. But here, you know, we've learned that there are all kinds of other non-trivial ground states which are not quite classified as simple as quantum Hall type. They have other kinds of, you know, non-local interactions, and perhaps there's other kinds of, you know, things that they can be used for, which is different from quantum computing. Let me give you a couple of examples of this kind of interesting ground state. This one that many people in this room have worked on leads to what has come to be known as artificial electrodynamics. This means that, you know, so there are examples, many examples by now, of models of interacting quantum spin or boson or some other kinds of models in three-dimension, three space dimensions, with interesting ground states that support gapless photon-like excitations. Right? So here, if you were to use the language of emergent gauge theory, then it's not some topological gauge theory, a gauge theory in a topological phase, but rather exactly the kind that you were asking about, things that have just, you know, have ordinary Maxwell theory emerge as the low energy description of some ordinary boson or spin model. Right? So the growing number of specific models that realize this kind of phase in a variety of different systems, and this photon excitation is to be distinguished from the usual photon. It has nothing to do with the usual photon. It's some internal collective mode of the degrees of freedom in the solid. And it is gapless, and this gaplessness is robust and protected, completely protected against all small perturbations to the original microscopic quantum system. Pretty much, this, you know, pretty analogous to the topological protection of, you know, the ground state degeneracy in a topologically ordered state. So this sort of robustness perhaps is useful in some context, you know, to do something. Maybe it's not quantum computing, maybe, I don't know, it's to transmit information or something, I don't know. But given that these phases exist, and, you know, the level of theoretical structure, at least I feel, and I think most of the people who worked on this probably feel, that this is just as well understood, and it's an as solid a footing as, you know, let's say a Z2 topological phase. So if one can start thinking about, you know, interesting applications of topologically ordered insulators with Z2 or perhaps some non-abelian structure, then why not start thinking about interesting possible applications of the robustness that exists in protecting things like this artificial gapless photon?
Can I ask, because this is, the fact that it is robust is very surprising in some sense. I mean, I would think if you have a theory where there is no local gauge symmetry at all in the beginning, and you, so what is the clue to the robustness here in this in these particular examples? Not the topological type, but this type.
Oh.
Because how does that, is there a simple way to kind of pin down where that really...
Oh, there's still some topological structure here that protects this artificial photon, but, you know, there are many ways to think about it. So, one mathematical way is that the low energy effective theory is a, you know, this Maxwell gauge theory, and the microscopic Hamiltonian, on the other hand, is gauge invariant, and the only...
But it's, you know, a global symmetry you start off with, probably.
That's right. So it's not that...
So how do you get this local symmetry realized in massless propagating mode, and how can you... I mean, what is the clue of the protection? I don't understand.
Okay, so there's another way to think about it, which is that, you know, really what's emerging is, or these, I mean, when one says artificial photon, what when emerging is that, what's emerging is fluctuating field lines, which are electric field lines and magnetic field lines of this electromagnetic field. So these are extended objects that are fluctuating in this phase, and local perturbation that you add to the Hamiltonian, you know, cannot quite get rid of these fluctuating extended objects that have managed to emerge at low energies in the theory. I mean, that's a sort of very hand-waving way to think about it, but, yeah.
I'm trying to understand the use of the terminology emergent here.
Right.
That you use. I mean, if I take any interacting solid-state system, you know, one of them interacting solid system, that are all kinds of emergent collective modes.
Absolutely.
Many original Hamiltonians don't put them in.
That's right.
And, you know, plasma is the easiest example.
That's right.
And plasma is robust because it's protected by if some, you know, current conservation or some other.
Right, aspect, but right? You can kill the plasmon if you, you know, break charge conservation,
sure.
For instance, by coupling it strongly to a superconductor, while here, you do anything you want.
By doing what? By coupling it to what?
Oh, put huge contact with a superconductor. Right? With a good mean field superconductor, well below its transmission temperature, you know.
Why the plasma be killed?
Oh, in the sense that, you know, to the extent that you can, this much bigger superconducting system, to the extent that you can treat that as a much bigger mean field that's, you know, that the electrons in the metal see. I know, but, you know, it's this thing that you, if you make the superconductor much, much bigger than the metal you're interested in, then you can sort of at some zeroth order thing sort of assume that it's only providing a mean field, you know, Cooper pair amplitude for the metal. So in that sense, you've destroyed charge conservation.
I don't think it's very big.
I know, but we're discussing issues of principle.
I still don't understand the difference. I mean, what is the difference between this mode? You'll tell us about some microscopic mode.
No, I'm not going to, but I can tell
you
want.
Right. And that microscopic mode will have some collective modes.
That's right.
It happens that this collective mode is an artificial photon.
Right.
Why is it any different from having any, you know, run-of-the-mill solid state system where interacting
with a photon? Right. So let me give you a more mathematical sort of thing. Right? So take a run-of-the-mill solid-state Hamiltonian, for instance, plasmon, or, you know, anything. Right? So break the symmetry in the microscopic Hamiltonian explicitly in some way. Right? For instance, phonon, you know, pin the solid. Right? You'll kill the phonon. Right? But here, add any small term that breaks any symmetry of the Hamiltonian, you know, nothing will happen to the photon. It's, at least if the term is small, you know, it's robust.
But I think the point was, I mean, these other things usually, maybe there is something like the Wolfstone theorem or something that produces a massless mode and it's well understood. How do you get massless vector degree of freedom while when you do not start off with a local symmetry, with a local invariant? That, I think, is highly non-trivial. I mean, of course, it comes from high energy physics, but there were a few rules. If you want to have massless fermions, you have a certain way to protect that. You have Goldstone bosons, these are the scalars, and so forth. This is standard stuff. And if you now tell me I start with any abundance matter system, I can produce these local vector degrees of freedom, that is, of course, very, very interesting and highly non trivial. Because normally you would have to build
That's right, it's not gapless either.
No, it's a gapless mode here, and that's the crucial part.
It can be gapless, depends on dimensionality. It's not gapless, that's...
Yeah, square root k.
You ask about the kind of freedom he's taking. Other say, make Coulomb interaction something else, it'll be gapless. I mean, plasma's gapless is not a fundamental problem.
No, fine. So in the plasmon case, you know, there's a level of theoretical discussion. Add to your microscopic Hamiltonian a term which explicitly allows a destruction of pair of electrons. But that's what I was trying to do with this big superconductor, but okay.
You're saying nothing will disturb this mode.
Exactly. It's, you know, it's robust in the same way this Gaussian degeneracy in a topological phase is robust. The gapless is completely protected against small perturbation. So feels to me that that must be useful for something in the long run, you know. It's the spirit of this program to think about these futuristic applications of interesting robust phases. And one can go on with this artificial electrodynamics and do something even better. You know, in all these situations where this photon emerges, it's coupled minimally to artificial sources of the photon, artificial gate charges, and also actually artificial magnetic monopoles. There are situations in which one could imagine that these gate charges are fermionic and gapless, in which case what you have created is an artificial metal. And it's not, you know, idle thought, and there are specific models that one can write down which realize this artificial metal phase in three dimension. It's an example I'm familiar with because I've worked on it, but I imagine there are many other such models with this artificial metal phase in three dimension, right? Where there are gate charge carriers that are coupled to this photon, which are mobile. In the spirit of this program, from the point of view of theoretical status, the artificial metal is not much inferior to any of the other phases that we know and love. You know, the topologically ordered states, the state with the gapless photon, but no gapless charge. So all of these are theoretically at more or less the same, you know, they have the same standing. There are specific models that where we can demonstrate that these exist, but none of them have been seen in real experiments. Right? So we know they exist, but, you know, we don't quite know where yet. In the spirit of this program, while thinking about possible things one could do with these interesting phases, we restrict ourselves to topological phases. Let's consider phases with artificial protons and finally to artificial metals. So what applications might artificial metals have? I don't know. But again, imagine that 50 years from now these were available readily in any store. What could we do with an artificial metal that we perhaps can't do with an ordinary metal? Could we imagine interesting electrical circuits made from wires in this artificial metallic phase, and so on and so forth? So there's some interesting differences with ordinary metals, because this artificial electrodynamics, the radiation, for instance, can't get out of this wire. It's after all confined to be inside the wire, right? There's no sense. It's an internal collective mode of the solid. For instance, if you transmit some signal using such an artificial wire, then perhaps you won't have any radiation loss. I don't know.
Can I just question just to show angles? Graphene, massless carriers, no gap, is that an artificial metal?
Oh, those are real electrons, no?
Well, they're real electrons, but they're massless, they're minimum dispersion relation, there's no gap. It's supposed to, I mean, it's usually seen as a system which models with these little energies, QED.
It's a good question, because, you know, what really is the difference between an ordinary metal, perhaps even ordinary extended more generally, to include places like graphene, and this sort of artificial metal? Like, so in graphene or any ordinary metal, you know, the charge carriers basically electrons, right? Electron-like quasi-particles. Perhaps the spectrum is different, you know, perhaps linear dispersion instead of a Fermi surface, but, you know, they're all morally Fermi liquids. Right? Well, here, for instance, in this specific model, whatever is gapless has no electrical charge. It's electrically neutral, but it carries some other charge. It carries charge of that couples to this artificial photon, but not to the real photon of the outside world. Right? So in that sense, you know, it's completely different. So this material is actually an electrical insulator as far as, you know, most of us are concerned.
So what kind of charge is it? A billion charge, a non-abelian charge?
Oh, in this context, it's abelian charge. That's right. There's an abelian gauge field, gapless gauge field, and it's coupled to, and this guy carries charge of that gauge field.
But that's just misdirected. There's no restrictions, right?
Okay, so that's an interesting question that's open for study, whether you could have gapless, non-abelian, you know, gapless metals, for instance, artificial metals with non-abelian gauge fields, are they stable quantum phases in physical dimension? Right? The answer is not at all obvious. It's not clear to me that they will be stable quantum phases.
And they derive from a spin degree of freedom?
That's right.
So these are spin liquids?
They're spin liquids, that's right.
So I have an elemental question.
Yeah.
What's the units of this charge?
Units?
Right. Like
one.
You know, what's the dimension? Is there a dimension full coupling constant in this theory, or there is none?
I see.
Is the charge measured in Coulomb or in spring tension, or I don't know, or in constant? What is the charge measured in?
Right. So there is an energy scale in the theory which sets the stiffness for the, it's sort of like the dielectric constant, roughly the analog of the dielectric constant for this photon. But you can interpret that, you know, as at some level as some measure of the strength of the coupling between the these charge degrees of freedom and, you know, the photon. So that's a measure of, you know, the strength of the electric field fluctuations. Right? So that can give you a measure of the electric charge.
Let me start by that. So two such charged particles attract or repel?
Two such charged particles, depends on whether they're like charge or like charges will repel. Static like charges.
Depends on theory. Scalar theories they attract. In gauge theories they repel. What's the setting here?
Sorry? Two like charges will repel. Oh, sure. No, there's just, there's just ordinary electrodynamics. The low energy theory is just ordinary electrodynamics. So you can just apply everything one has learned from Jackson, you know.
So, okay, so there is a dimension less. Is H-bar still an element of the theory? And the velocity of light is over the base, is not.
Okay, so the velocity of light is, you know, so that's sort of determined, not, it's not the same velocity as in free space, but there's some other energy scale and length scale that comes into the theory that is set by microscopic physics that depends on details of the microscopic Hamiltonian. Right?
And what would be the analog of alpha in this theory?
So, you know, there is a dimensionless ratio that you can form of various energy scales in the problem, which, and basically that number would typically be of order 1. So if you wish, you're doing the only difference with usual electrodynamics is that your fine structure constant is of order 1. Right? There's no particular reason to expect that this alpha is small. In this case, all, you know,
That's a computable quantity in the theory.
Oh, as a matter of principle, but in practice it may be difficult, you know, starting from a microscopic Hamiltonian to compute quantities of this sort. In any case, I sort of wanted to mention this just to say, you know, why restrict attention to topological phases? Why not go all the way and think about all the other phases that we know can exist and speculate about, you know, wires with artificial, made of artificial metals. So these are examples that we think we understand quite well. So let me now talk about examples that are much more recent and where we understand some things but don't quite understand them completely well. So the buzzword here is deconfined criticality in two dimensions. So for instance, here's an example of a stable quantum phase which again has some weird interesting topological structure which we only partially understand. So these are phases of quantum spin systems in two dimensions, quantum antiferromagnets or something, whose low energy theory basically consists of, again, these gapless, electrically neutral, meaning as far as physical electric charge is concerned, emergent fermions that are coupled to fluctuating gapless emergent gauge fields. Right. So this again, I don't know, should one call this a topological phase or not, I don't know. But it's a scale invariant quantum state, so this is a fixed point that describes a state which has no relevant perturbations that are allowed by the symmetries of the microscopic spin Hamiltonian. So for various reasons, we like to call this a deconfined critical phase, but that's not so important. And analogous to this, there are deconfined critical points whose low energy theory described by more or less the same theoretical structure, except that we have bosons instead of fermions. And now, the corresponding fixed point describes the scale invariant theory, but with one relevant perturbation that's allowed by the microscopic symmetries. So these often turn out to describe phase transitions between two different quantum phases that are forbidden within the standard Landau thinking on phase transitions. So in this general theme of going beyond topological phases, you know, the artificial electrodynamics case is quite well understood, we feel, at least as well understood as the topological phases. But the deconfined criticality, sort of critical topological phase, or critical topological critical point, is not quite well understood, but it also has some emergent non-local structure that the gauge theory is trying to capture. Right? So why do we have to describe these states in terms of gauge theory? I don't know. It probably means that there's some non-locality that somehow they're trying to get our hands on through this mathematical description in terms of gauge theory. So, you know, the distant future, perhaps one can imagine asking questions like, if they're indeed, how exactly do we disentangle this non-local structure in the theory, and does it have any interesting application? Obviously a much more difficult question to even think about at this stage. But in any case, so I just wanted to give this background in terms of things that are going on in condensed matter physics, not just on experimental searches for topological phases, but theoretical work going beyond quantum Hall type topological phases. And certainly, I think there's been lots of progress and lots of interesting states that we know can exist, and lots of interesting critical points. And perhaps all these, you know, could lend themselves to interesting sort of applications as well. I mean, not just for quantum computing, but other things. For the rest of the talk, I'm just going to focus on some theoretical aspects of these phenomena. Then hopefully this gives you the right background and tells you how this body of work in ordinary solid-state physics could perhaps be useful for some interesting, you know, quantum technology in the future.
Yeah. One thing you said is, well, you could use this as a wire and send instead of electrical wave diagrams, it's artificial.
Right.
How would you read them out again?
Right. So I was thinking about that. Then it occurred to me, look, it's hard to do, right? But that's the same issue as with quantum computing, because the big issue is how do you couple to these qubits, how do you read out, and so on. So let's postpone that problem to the future, right?
There are specific ideas how to do that in quantum computing.
Right.
I'm wondering how to do
that. Hopefully there'll be specific ideas in the future how to do these things for artificial metal. I don't know.
This is not non-dependent as a matter of principle.
I haven't given it much thought. You know, I just put this in the slide yesterday. It came to my head, but it's something that'd be very good, interesting to talk about, I think. You know,
an energy transport can presumably be associated.
Yeah, that's it.
So
absolutely.
Now,
exactly. Exactly. So all kinds of interesting things one can think about. It may be a good topic for discussion. You know, good topic to think about. I don't know. At least take baby steps in the direction to stimulate more people to work on these problems and so on. I don't. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So he said that the non-local gauge search gauge theory is necessary to capture some uncertainty in non-locality. But where does the non-locality come from? Because for me, the gauge theory is a kind of effective action when you are direct when you grant set manifold in macroscopic engineering. But where does the non-locality come from?
Let's take the quantum Hall example, for instance. Right? So there you have the statistical interaction.
But in other cases, where does the non-locality come from? Is there some necessity to introduce a non-locality?
The gauge description. So, you know, if the gauge description, the gauge theory that you like, you know, of the kind that you're talking about in the degenerate manifold, sorry?
In the context of matter physics.
Right.
What is
so let's take the example you mentioned where there's some low energy degenerate manifold and you write some effective, you know, theory in this manifold and it looks like a gauge theory. Now if that gauge theory happens to be in some deconfined state, then in that state the quasi-particles of that state or whatever low energy theory you have of that state will have in a simple case they'll have non-local interactions. So that's the non-locality. It's not necessarily there each time you have a degenerate manifold. You also need the effective Hamiltonian go into this liquid type phase, like this deconfined state. Okay. Is that more or less time? Okay. So this is going to be... This is the beginning of the talk. But, you know, it doesn't matter. The actual talk that I was going to give was some, as I said, the latest of my contributions to this, you know, growing body of knowledge, interesting quantum phases and their theoretical descriptions. For this program, that's perhaps not so important as, you know, some of the more general background type things. So let me sort of, I'll stop whenever people are ready to go. So let me sort of give you some flavor at least for the actual talk. So the playground, the setting in which most of this, most of the thinking, this kind of thing gets done, is an insulating quantum magnets, quantum antiferromagnets, in a Mott insulator. It's a very useful theoretical laboratory to address many of the questions that we need to confront in solid state, in strongly correlated solid state physics. That's one reason to study such models. The other reason is that there are many, many new materials realizing a variety of such models on different lattices that are being synthesized you know, every day. So that's, you know, so it's good empirical motivation to study quantum magnetism. So let me discuss some simple possible quantum phases, not the interesting, these are interesting, but not the exotic topological kind, but the non-topological conventional states. Nail-ordered state, presumably familiar to everyone. This room, spins just go up, down, or let's say on a square lattice. So this state breaks spin rotation symmetry of the underlying microscopic Hamiltonian, if such a symmetry exists. Other possible quantum phases, one that is very popular is what's known as a quantum paramagnet. The simplest is a valence bond solid, where if you have spin half sitting on the sides of a square lattice, you can imagine that each spin half finds one particular partner spin half with which it forms a singlet bond, a valence bond, and the singlet bonds are in themselves in some pattern, which in this case is just some columnar pattern, and this ordered pattern of valence bonds clearly breaks various lattice symmetries, breaks lattice translations, lattice rotations, and so on. And the elementary spinful excitations in the state correspond to breaking one of these singlets, promoting it to a triplet, and letting that delocalize a little bit. So it's a spin one gapped excitation above a spin gap. We also believe that there are exotic quantum paramagnets known in the field as resonating valence bond liquids, and so these could be in a topological phase, or one of the other interesting phases that I talked about, which have non-trivial topological structure. So there have been, you know, a number of advances over the years. So that this talk was going to focus on two recent advances. One is the possibility of having second-order phase transitions in such quantum antiferromagnets magnets between two phases which break completely different symmetries. For instance, the nail state that I talked about breaks spin rotation, and this valence bond solid preserves spin rotation but breaks lattice symmetries. Right? So it's become clear that the direct second-order quantum phase transition is possible between these two states that break very different symmetries, even though within conventional Landau-type thinking on phase transition theory, such a phase transition, such a second-order phase transition would require some fine-tuning, require more fine-tuning than an ordinary critical point. The critical field theory, as I mentioned already, consists of gapless bosonic gate charges which carry spin. They come to be known as spinons in the field, to couple to fluctuating gauge fields. And right at the critical point, you have slow Pearl or decay for the correlations of both the obvious order parameters, both the nail order parameter and the VBS order parameter. This is what they've called the deconfined quantum critical point. And the other related advance is the possibility of these stable critical spin liquid phases in two dimensions. At least as things stand, the stability is only demonstrated within some systematic log-n expansion of equivalent spin models. But the low energy theory in this case, it's a fermionic analog of the theory of the boson of the deconfined critical point. Here you have gapless fermionic Dirac particles which carry spin, that are coupled to a gapless gauge field. And once again, if you look at ordinary order parameters, you know, conventional classical order parameters, there are a large number of them that it turns out have slow Pearl or decays. So this phase is almost ordered in that sense, living at the edge, has slow Pearl or decay for a number of ordinary order parameters, but not quite any of them. So are these exotic critical points or phases? You know, the existing descriptions mostly have been in terms of gauge theories. That's where, you know, there's this feeling that there's some non-local structure in the ground state wave functions that this gauge theory is trying to capture. But the thing to realize is that unlike in, say, topological phases that one may be used to, in this, you know, in these systems, even though these descriptions are useful, there's no quasi-particle description that we know of the excitation spectrum. These are interacting critical points, and neither the spinons nor the photon is a good quasi-particle, even though they provide the variables in terms of which you know, the simplest field theory seems to be written, and quite possibly there's no quasi-particle description at all. So these are ground states of matter with no quasi-particle descriptions.
So is the argument behind that we just haven't been able to find one, or is there?
So far, I'll talk about attempts that. This talk was supposed to be about attempts to find one.
Because I was saying 1 plus 1D, you know, you have all these... Right,
I'll talk about 1 plus 1 in a minute. Yeah.
There is nothing obvious, but 1s exist, even though
there's nothing... Sure, sure. Yeah, no, let's talk about 1 plus 1D in a minute. So the questions are, you know, is a spin-on gauge description necessary at these critical points and faces, or can we do away with them altogether? You know, really trying to understand better exactly in what, I mean, how non-local is this theory? I mean, to what extent is the non-locality crucial? Is it necessary to capture it in terms of a gauge theory? And so on and so forth. For instance, you might wonder whether there's a direct description in terms of the slow competing order parameters. You know, for instance, for this Deakin-Fine critical point is a phase transition between one ordered state and the other ordered state. And a diehard Landau theorist would just write down a theory in terms of the two obvious order parameters, and then give them, you know, let them vary in space somewhat, and time, and then say that's it, right? So how does that kind of theory kill itself? Right? Apparently that description is wrong at some level, so how does it go wrong? And, you know, and why bother with these questions? I don't know, I mean, mostly just to understand the whole thing better at this stage, but maybe it'll be useful.
That's probably the minor issue for what you're talking about, but you, of course, have examples of a phase transition where Lambda-Gisbert-Boltzmann theory is irrelevant, localization.
Sure, but there you don't have order parameters to even describe the two phases. But here we have good order parameters to describe both phases. Nevertheless, you know, there's a problem. So if I'd given the full talk, I would have suggested some interesting answers by studying related questions. Now, I'll still suggest those interesting answers, but perhaps not give you the details of what actually happens. So just to set the stage for, you know, how the answer might look like, let's take some lessons from well-known examples, spin half chains in 1D, the classic beta chain. It is basically, you know, the best known example of a gapless spin liquid state of spin systems. The polar phase, we know there's a description of the spectrum in terms of fractional spin excitations, spin on excitations. And we know, at least, you know, humankind has known for a long time that the slow decay of both the nail and VBS correlations with the same exponents, I actually hadn't appreciated this till last year, after reading a paper that Leon wrote. And there are many similarities to 2D Deakin-Fine criticality, except that, you know, it's 1D and we understand it all a lot better. There are a number of different equivalent field theoretic descriptions. Let me very, very quickly run you through some of these. A very popular one is due to Haldane, which describes this as an O3 nonlinear sigma model in two space-time dimensions with a topological theta term, which counts, the number of times the end field, wraps around two-dimensional space-time. And the nail order parameter is just the end field itself, the end vector. Well, the VBS order parameter is somewhat subtle in this description. It's the topological density. And, you know, though in the final low-energy theory, these two have the same correlations, that equivalence is not at all obvious in this description. Right? It treats nail and VBS very, very unequally. Right? So there's a problem. You know, it's sort of not close enough to the fixed point to get the physics right. There's another description in terms of wisdom in orbital theory, SU2 level 1. I got the feeling from last week that everyone in this room sort of grew up with SU2 level K. Right? SUN level K, O3 level 3. Someone was telling me about it. So I don't really need to explain to you what this theory is. If someone doesn't know, just ask your neighbor. Most likely he will. But the key point is that it's written in terms of an SU2 matrix, and there's a term that sort of looks topological, people know what it is. And this theory, interestingly, has higher symmetry than the microscopic model. It has separate symmetries under left and right multiplication of the SU2 matrix by a global SU2 matrix. So it's really SU2 cross SU2 which as some people will know, the same as SO4. So this theory, this description of the spin half chain, provides you the theory with SO4 symmetry. And indeed, an SU2 matrix basically lives on S3. Right? This means that, you know, if you think of this SU2 matrix as a vector in S3, then you can do global rotations on the surface of S3, and, you know, the theory is invariant under that. So that actually gives you a nice explanation of the equivalence of the Nail and Rabeus correlations, because in this description, if you wrote your SU2 matrix, expanded it out in a basis, this way identity plus I times and sigma matrices, then the SO4 symmetry rotates this 4 vector, but one can argue that these components are precisely the Nail vector, and the identity part is precisely the VBS order parameter. So in that sense, you know, it's a very useful perspective on this theory as applied to spin chains, which is that this is really some sort of super spin sigma model that focuses on the slowly fluctuating order parameters and writes down, you know, the obvious sigma model you would, except that to really get the physics right, you need to include the Wiese-Zumino term. Naive Landau-Ginzburg thinking, you know, why would you write the Wiese-Zumino term? But you need to do it to correctly get the physics. But the interesting thing is that such a superspin description exists for, you know, the 1D spin chain. There's yet another description in terms of slave spin-ons, something very... Yeah.
So you rewrote just the SU2 WW model in terms of some 4 vectors, so it looks like an SO4 model.
That's right. It has, you know, SO4 symmetry, so...
And then it's just a regular non-Wiese model with a topological term. And what does the topological term look like in terms of this...
It's the same thing, you know, extend, you know, the space-time...
It looks just
some way of rewriting it. It just makes the equivalence of Nail and VBS operators, you know, makes the equivalence of the correlators obvious. But so that's one use of this SU2 level 1 theory, even though directly it may be hard to compute. It's much better than the O3 at theta equals pi, because there the symmetry is not obvious at all.
Does it end up looking like, you know, the Wiese-Zumino terms are used to for magnets, you know, for quantum magnets?
Meaning? For quantum magnets, usually you think about this theta term, right?
Okay.
Oh, yeah, it's the same as, yeah.
No, sorry, that's not right. I mean, for a ferromagnet, there is this very famous term.
Right, right.
By extending to a higher dimensional.
That's it. So this will look exactly the same.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's exactly the same thing. You know, so geometrically, you know, it's this volume in S3, okay, bounded by the surface traced out by this 4 vector field, divided by the total volume of S3.
So if I have a spin chain, like this, let's say how the attraction spin chain when I have spin,
right,
how can I think of the VBS order parameter in that case?
I mean, it's just...
Basically.
Oh, it's just the bond energy at, you know, pi, at wave vector pi. But SI dot SI plus 1, Fourier transform to be near wave vector pi. But, so that's the VBS order. Yeah, the fact that the Nail and VBS have equal correlations in that state has been known for, as I said, known to humankind for a long time, and certainly to Leon for much longer than me. But maybe not to humankind, to Leon, but, you know, I think it's useful to see it, to have a field theory which sort of focuses just on this slow competing order parameter. Say, look, let me just write down, you know, a theory just in terms of the slow order parameters, and here it is. But it's just a different perspective on usual.
So, here the SO4, so in addition to the 3-spin, the other 3 generators, we can place the VBS to the Nail. What are these generators correspond?
Man, they are spin 1, they are pi particles, you know, just spin 1, spin 1 momentum, I guess, 0, right? Because both Nail and VBS are momentum pi, so, you know, that's something, you know, you can write them down. This another very interesting lesson from a spin half chain. You can try to do something that's very popular in higher dimensions, write the spin in terms of fermions with a local constraint, and then try to solve the problem in mean field, and at the mean field level you'd get a tight binding band of these F particles at half filling. So the tight binding band is 2 Fermi points, and Mudry's, Christopher, sitting right out here, he was one of the perpetrators of this wonderful story. Now the fluctuations about this mean field are gauge fluctuations, and in the simplest setup, you can describe it as massless two-component QED2, you know, two-component Schwinger model. And we can bosonize this theory, you know, pretty much as usual. And the charge sector gets gapped because of the coupling to the gauge field, and you can throw it out, you can integrate out the gauge fluctuations. Exactly. What you're left with is just the spin physics, which is SU2 level 1. Right? So in this case, you know, you see that the slave spin-ons of the gauge fields are not part of the physical spectrum. The physical spectrum is described by a completely different theory. The spin-on of the spin-half chain has very little to do with this slave spin-on, with this F particle. In any case, the lesson, so the superspin field theory in terms of slow competing orders is possible, but requires a topological term. And the slave spin-on and gauge fields are a possible but not necessary description of the physics, and then really not part of this physical spectrum. So I'm obviously not going to give much of this talk, but I'll just mention some of the results. The first thing one can ask is whether in two dimensions, if one were to describe competing ordered, you know, competition between classical order parameters in two-dimensional quantum systems, two-dimensional quantum magnets, you know, traditionally, at least within a certain community in the last many years, we've always done that through some version of gauge theory. We've tried to formulate the problem in terms of, you know, spin-ons coupled to a gauge field, analyze the gauge theory. Well, at least morally, that's what we've always done. I ended up with various descriptions and felt like we've understood it all. But to what extent can this sort of competition be captured within conventional Van der Waals thinking? What goes wrong? You know, so one place to start is because we know how to do it for 1D spin chains, start from weakly coupled 1D spin chains, two dimensions, namely a 2D square lattice, but now with rectangular, 2D rectangular lattice. And then to ask the same questions about various other kinds of field theory that have come up in studies of frustrated quantum magnets. So I'm not going to do any of this simply because there's no time, but I'd be happy to talk to people about it, unless people really want me to show the details.
There's probably not enough time for you to show the details, but you should kind of wrap up.
I should wrap up, right? So let me just give you the conclusion for each one of these topics. Starting from weakly coupled spin chains and starting from the continuum field theory, the SU2 level 1 theory, for each chain, we can ask about the effective low energy theory when you couple together the chains for a rectangular lattice. And, you know, the answers, again, in terms of this 4-vector, phi naught and phi, where phi, once again, represents the nail order parameter in two dimensions, now at wave vector pi pi, and it's a vector field, vector as far as spin rotation is concerned, and phi naught, or the rectangular lattice, is simply the columnar VBS order parameter. It tells you whether dimers lie on even rows or on odd rows. Right? So the two natural order parameters, one is a spin vector, the other is a scalar, and so there are four components to the order parameter. Right? So if you just go ahead and derive this field theory, what you end up with is, you know, the nice thing that you would get right down is just this sort of sigma model for this four-component order parameter field, three of which are the nail order parameter and the fourth is the VBS order parameter. But if you actually carry through the derivation, you see that there's an extra term which is purely topological, and it's actually, it counts the number of times this four-component unit vector winds around space-time, which is S3. Right? So this is the exact analog of Haldane in two dimensions, in 1 plus 1. Right? So you end up with an O4 sigma model with a theta term at theta equals pi, and this is clearly the required superspin sigma model. Right? It's written entirely in terms of the natural competing order parameters, but it has this term that, you know, one can't just guess, you know, on symmetry grounds or something. It has to be justified by microscopics. So there's some anisotropy because this theory, you know, that these two order parameters are not microscopically equal. And so there's some anisotropy that breaks this O4 down in some way.
Why is this not anisotropic?
Sorry? That's this guy. So this G lives on S3. Right. Well, it's just more or less the same SU2 matrix that one has for each spin chain. Now you're just coupling together these spin chains to get, you know. That's right. That's exactly right. Experiential space time. That's right. Right.
Why is there no anisotropy
in 1 plus 1D? Well, 1 plus 1D is there microscopically, but it sort of renormalizes away as you go to the low energy fixed point. The fixed point has higher symmetry than the original. We know that because we can solve, you know, even the field theory, we understand it quite well.
This behavior is very analytical. Non-analytical in N, right? If I would go to O5 or some other...
O5 will make an appearance at some later stage. Sorry?
I would have no
modules. No, I told you a bit. O5 will make an appearance, you know, the... let me not bother with the rest. We can basically show that this theory is completely equivalent, you know, reproduces everything we know about from other descriptions of Spinhoff quantum magnets on rectangular lattice. But it treats the Neil and Vibier's order parameters on an equal footing, unlike the more traditional, you know, gauge theoretic descriptions, which don't do that. Right? So once again, one is able to write a superspin theory, but at the cost of including this non-trivial topological term, and, you know, in the long run, it's not clear whether this is superior to the usual description, because we know very little about gauge theories, about, you know, sigma models with topological terms. I'll come to that in a minute. That's the next thing.
What do you mean by correctly?
You say correctly described? So, you know, for the rectangular lattice, we sort of have some understanding of what the possibilities are from various other considerations, right? Dimer models, equivalent, you know, Fine-Gordon models, gauge theories. And all of those results can be recovered from this formulation. You can actually, you know, because the theory has some anisotropy, you can actually handle the theory. There are hedgehog type defects, but where in the core, you know, the hedgehog type defects of the Neil order parameter, where in the core you have VBS ordering, and you can analyze the effects of the theta term for these defects and then work out, you know, you can basically map it on to the usual descriptions.
So what you mean is that it matches the other descriptions?
That's right, exactly.
And in this approach, you still have a generic second order transition between two order states.
No, on a rectangular lattice, most of us, I guess, believe that, you know, such a generic second-order transition is not allowed in principle.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, so this, since this approach matches on with other descriptions, you know, it doesn't change that conclusion. Okay. Right, except with this non-local topological term, which gives non-trivial weights to different topological sectors. So is this the minimal sort of,
what is the microscopic kind of?
Oh, a couple spin chains, you know,
Heisenberg
with, on 2D rectangular lattice, maybe with some diagonal bonds as well. Okay, so let me quickly describe some of the other results. Now let me go on to isotropic 2D square lattice, where I said there's a possibility of direct second-order Landau-Forbidden transition between the Neil state and now a four-fold degenerate VBS ground state. Where in the conventional description is again in terms of gauge theory. And here, following actually ideas from a paper that appeared last year, but you know, there are certain aspects of that paper which I didn't quite. I thought it could be done better, so there's a re-derivation of those results. So what you end up with in this case, now the set of order parameters, there are five order parameters, right? The Neil vector is a three-component spin, so three real numbers to specify the Neil field, and VBS, it's a two-component VBS order parameter. That's what you need to describe the four possible VBS ordering patterns. Right?
So, all right, since you guys are quick, this is a theory in how many space-time dimensions?
Oh, two space one-time dimensions.
Still 2 + 1.
That's right.
Okay.
So now I have, you know, the number of order parameter components is 5, and the natural sigma model would have been an SO5 sigma model.
So the difference between this and what you were just doing before, there's no longer anisotropic?
That's right. It's a 2D square lattice with full square symmetry instead of a rectangular lattice. Right? So for the VBS order parameter, it obviously matters whether it's rectangular or square. Right? So the natural guess would have been just an SO5 sigma model. There's wonderful derivation of the appropriate field theory, and you indeed see that there's a Wes-Zumino term for this 5-component order parameter field, which appears in this 2+1 dimensional quantum field theory. So this is what you need to correctly reproduce, you know, the physics of the competition between the Nail and VBS order parameters in on a 2+1 dimensional square lattice, 2D square lattice.
I do not understand. Do not understand this topological term now, because this map S3 into S4 is usually contractible.
No, that's right. So it's a Wes-Zumino term. It's not a theta term. Right? So what this is, it's basically equal to the fraction or the total volume of S4, you know, bounded by the surface traced out by this five-component unit vector, divided by the total volume of S4. With the Wes-Zumino term in the usual sense, it's the Wes-Zumino term. Right. So you can ask, you know, how at all is this equivalent to the earlier gauge theoretic descriptions in terms of CP1 models? So the answer to that is not known in general, but there's one case in which we were actually able to show the equivalence. So that's the case in which the quantum magnet has an easy plane anisotropy.
So are you also including terms that break the SO5 down to...
Oh, they should be there. Yeah, so they'll be there as extra terms. And to actually show the equivalence, you need those extra terms. So as this is fluctuating on S4, there's some anisotropy, which, you know...
S4 is broken, or is it...
S4 is not a symmetry of the theory, just the manifold on which...
I mean, is it the manifold is really S4, or is some S4 some
It's some anisotropy. It's a distorted S4.
There's no obvious description of
There's some obvious anisotropy, you know. The Nail vector, the first three components, you know, have slightly different stiffness, let's say, from the other two components.
It's not some symmetric space or something like that.
Oh, I don't know what a symmetric space is, so I can't answer the question. You can tell me later. Must include this anisotropy, as I just mentioned, and here are these five components, or, you know, the five obvious order parameter components. So in the case with easy plane anisotropy, one can actually show the equivalence of this theory to the most standard gauge theoretic descriptions. Right? So that, you know, basically, you know, if you restrict it to have easy plane, that means that one of the components of the Nail vector has been set to zero. Then you get an O4 theory, and then this Wes-Zumino term just reduces to the usual theta term for the O4 theory. But now you have O2 cross O2 anisotropy. And in this case, one can actually make some progress. This theta term can then be interpreted as giving mutual pi statistics to the vortices of the two O2 order parameters. These are the components of the VBS order parameter. That's right. Okay. So basically, the topological term implies that this. Anyway, Mike Friedman gave us some very useful help in understanding the effect of this topological term. But what it does is to basically give you this non-trivial mutual statistics of the vortices of the two O2 order parameters, and that in turn, through a fairly standard duality, can be shown to be equivalent to the earlier gauge actions that we've been working with. So at least in one case, one can follow the equivalence completely. Now this phase transition, the critical point between Nail and VBS in this easy plane case, has this O2 cross O2 symmetry times a discrete Z2 symmetry, which interchanges the two O2s. So this is something we've actually known about for a while, in the different gauge language, 102 is just the global, I've said charge, but global SZ conservation. The other 02 was described in the earlier description in terms of conservation of some gauge flux. And the Z2, sort of made a curious appearance in the earlier description. We knew that this critical point actually was a self-dual theory, something found by Lasik here, working with Ashwin Vishwanath. Now, in this field theoretic formulation, the Z2, which is a symmetry of the critical theory, just appears in ordinary symmetry, right? Not as some weird non-local self-dual thing, self-duality transformation. So once again, the superspin description of the Z-confined critical point is possible in terms of natural order parameters, but then you're forced to include this topological term. It's at least an alternate to gauge theory, a possible alternate. I don't know if it's a useful alternate, hard to say. Finally, let me very briefly mention this. One can think about massless QED3 in two dimensions with n-component Dirac fermion fields. The reason we're interested in this in solid state physics is that higher component versions of these describe possible deconfined critical phases, spin liquid phases of quantum magnets. At a set for n large enough, we know that it can be stable and describe a stable critical phase, but it has slow power law correlations for various gauge invariant fermion bilinears. So these are natural, slow, competing classical orders in this problem. So we don't know how to, so the question again, is there a description in terms of the slow competing classical orders? And at least in the n equals 2 case, with just two component Dirac fermions, and with some other restrictions, one can make some progress. And here, there's a global spin SU2, under which the spin offs rotate. We expect that the corresponding vector has slow correlations. So to bring that out, so this is where some of the restrictions come in. Imagine coupling this theory to a fluctuating n vector field that couples to this guy and integrate freely over this n vector, and then let's just study this theory. So in the limit in which the coefficient of that fluctuating or that coupling is large, one can integrate out the fermions and calculate the resulting fermion determinant using some nice results from Sasha Abanov and Paul Wigman. So there's some fairly complicated looking answer that emerges. You get an O3 sigma model, but now the gauge field couples this fermion current, and this O3 sigma model in 2 plus 1 dimensions also comes with this so-called Hopf term. But in the presence of this gauge coupling to the gauge field, we can now integrate out the gauge field exactly. And what it tells you then is that the fermion density stops fluctuating the theory, which means that, at long scales you don't have fermions, which basically then means that in the CP1 description, you can forget about the CP1 gauge field and get all this going very quickly. But, at the end of the day, you end up with O4 at theta equals pi. So at least in some limits, a theory with the same field content as n equals 2 massless QED3, which is a gauge theory, is equivalent to the sigma model, O4 at theta equals pi. Because, we don't know what either of these two theories does. So, Leon once asked me, what the heck I was doing. I can't answer questions in either language. But, so this sort of duality is actually, it's quite nice. And I guess Jason here recognized at least some aspects of it a little while ago, working with Matthew and Michael Hermele and Alexei Motronich. First, the O4 broken phase, there are three Goldstone modes, Now in QED3, when this n vector orders, there are again three gapless modes. There are two spin waves because the n vector is a pre-component vector that's ordered. But then the extra gapless mode is the gapless photon. So these have been united in this O4 description into the three Goldstone modes. So this sort of duality was conjectured by Jason and his friends based on very different types of analysis recently. And it's, so what I've shown you is some partial support for this sort of remarkable duality. But at least in the case in which, there's a derivation, it looks like one ends up with this extra topological term, which, you know, does whatever it does. Okay, so here's a summary. So slow computing orders, you know, possible in various, a sigma model description in terms of slow computing orders, possible in 2D quantum magnets, provided, you know, you remember that, you know, topological terms exist, either of the theta variety or of Wesum, you know, variety or whatever. But it's an alternate to gate theory descriptions, it's certainly possible. I don't even know if it's interesting, you know, it exists, but what good is it? I don't know. So based on these, you know, considerations, one can start guessing what this field theory might do. You know, the O4 model in 2 plus 1 dimensions with a theta term. So it, in the end, perhaps the maximum use is to provide some insight into, you know, the properties of these field theories based on mappings.
You understand these as just as being some kind of generalizations of sort of the old-fashioned Poulenc type theology?
No. At least I don't. There's actually some discrepancy with what these guys do, because these guys do something along those lines on a lattice, but then they don't find this theta term, theta equals pi. So we've been discussing it for a long time and haven't reached any consensus on what's going on. You know, so what I've shown is a direct continuum type duality, right? But on the specific lattice models that these guys worked with, they have other arguments which lead them to, you know, suspect or propose that it's O4 at theta equals zero.
So the term breaks time reversal?
Not that theta equals pi. Theta equals pi is special. Okay, so, you know, is there a similar description, boson-only description of this algebraic spin-liquid phase, which we've always described in terms of fermions coupled to a gauge field? I don't know. So what's the nature of the phase transition in the isotropic O4 model at theta equals pi in 3 dimensions? And finally, I think all the Xu Cheng, you know, followers in this room, and looks like there are many, perhaps there's something to worry about in, you know, in attempts to build a theory of correlated extended Hubbard models in terms of SO5 based on the number of components of the superconducting and antiferromagnetic order parameters. You know, topological terms exist, so maybe you have to worry about them. And they, in some sense, capture the lattice Berry phase effects, you know, the underlying microscopics. And so some, I haven't had time to talk at all about this, but if you take the same sort of considerations in 3 dimensions, quantum magnets in 3D, derive similar sigma models and ask, you again end up with theta terms at theta equals pi. And in turn, you know, at the end of the day, you get some complicated, strongly interacting field theory. But then one can try to guess what the field theory may do on the basis of our understanding of the quantum spin problem. And there's some interesting guesses that seem to be emerging. For instance, on what SU2 gauge theory at theta equals pi might do in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Anyway, so that's about it. Sorry, I've gone. So, on the.